You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
What is behind China's push into this space? Is it novel? When did it begin? Why are they doing this? And so the content of this report reflects my attempt to describe and demonstrate why China decided to proceed with this media campaign, what caused its behavior to change, and the way in which that campaign has or has not been successful.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Caveat, N2K CyberWire's privacy surveillance law and policy podcast. I'm Dave Bittner, and joining me is my co-host Ben Yellen from the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Hey, Ben.
Hello, Dave.
Ben has the latest on a TikTok bill making its way through Congress. I've got the EFF's brief to the Ninth Circuit Court on software copyright limits. And later in the show, my conversation with Dakota Carey from Sentinel Labs. We're talking about China's cyber-focused media campaign. While this show covers legal topics and Ben is a lawyer, the views expressed do not constitute legal advice. For official legal advice on any of the topics we cover, please contact your attorney. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. All right, Ben, let's kick things off here. I don't want to ding you for choosing the obvious story this week, but you chose the obvious story this week.
It's just too good not to talk about is basically what it comes down to.
Okay,
fair enough. So our members of Congress are considering a piece of legislation that's making its way through the House of Representatives, at least at a very rapid pace, that would force the parent company ByteDance to sell TikTok to an American investor. Within 165 days, if they fail to do so, TikTok could be removed from the Apple and Google app stores.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of really interesting, funny, important angles to the story. The first is this bill showed up on a House committee calendar. They were going to vote for it last Thursday. And TikTok put a little pop-up alert on everybody's account based on their zip code to call your member of Congress and tell them not to pass this piece of legislation.
Right.
That backfired big time. All these members of Congress got hundreds of thousands of calls from angry teenagers saying, you're going to shut down my business. You're going to shut down my ability to engage in social media and make short video clips. I'm an influencer.
I wonder how many of them were too young to vote.
Probably a lot of them, given the demographics of TikTok users.
Right.
But it made all of these offices extremely angry. And I do not doubt that that contributed to what was really a remarkable 50-0 vote in the House committee to advance this bill.
What?
Yeah. So when you get members from the far left of the Democratic caucus to the far right of the Republican caucus,
I mean, there's usually one crank in there somewhere, right?
There is almost always one crank. This was crank proof.
Oh, wow.
And beyond that, it has the support of House leadership. So it is coming to the floor of the House of Representatives as we're speaking here this week. And it's going to be voted on by the full House. And President Biden, in extemporaneous remarks that he made, I think, deboarding or boarding Air Force One, said that he supports this bill so that he would sign it into law.
Okay.
There are a few obstacles remaining here. The first is the great deliberative body known as the United States Senate, the cooling saucer of the passions of our House of Representatives.
Which has its own collection of cranks.
Yes. One of them is Rand Paul. And okay. Rand Paul has said, I have a lot of concerns about this bill. I might hold it up. And individual senators have a lot of power to hold up bills for a long time if they want to. Now, if you have 60 votes to advance a bill in the Senate, eventually it will pass. You can file cloture on the bill after the requisite time period has passed. Sometimes it's a period of days, maybe about a week. Then you can have a vote on the legislation. But perhaps that buys Rand Paul and his allies some time to conjure up 39 other members or 40 other members of the Senate from both parties who might be concerned about the potential constitutional issues here or might just think this is plainly bad policy.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be defeated. But right now, it seems like it's really on a glide path. So I thought it would be a good idea to talk about some of the constitutional issues here.
Right.
First is the First Amendment issue. There was a TikTok ban that passed the state legislature in Montana that we talked about, mm-hmm. and a federal judge said this was a huge inhibition on the First Amendment. This is the expressive mode for a lot of people. They communicate important political, artistic ideas over TikTok. It's not all just junk, although it's maybe mostly junk.
That's a lot of junk, sure.
So I think the First Amendment aspects of this are rather significant. Now, okay. The legislation as drafted wouldn't directly inhibit anybody's First Amendment rights. Even if TikTok were banned in the United States, people could post reels on Facebook or, you know, the equivalent short videos on Instagram. And I think that's what the government would argue if this case came in front of a federal court.
Hmm.
The other issue is something called a bill of attainder. Have you ever heard of a bill of attainder?
I've heard of it, but I would not be able to tell you what it means.
It's like it's a term that gets thrown around partly because it's in our Constitution. And basically, a bill of attainder means a bill that directly targets an individual or an entity and criminalizes something that individual either is doing or has done.
Mm.
So historical examples have been congressional efforts to zero out the salaries of individual members of a president's cabinet. Because it's targeted at one individual and it's punishing that person individually for their actions. There's some mixed case law on whether the bill of attainder would apply not just to an individual, but to a company. And what actually counts as a sufficient punishment that would trigger the protections of the Constitution in terms of bills of attainder. So that's unknown.
Okay.
So we have those two major constitutional issues that are, I think, are hanging over this. And then there's the political angle. And this really fascinates me. Like, what do you do if you're Joe Biden? You get this bill presented to you. He said he's going to sign it. He's having problems with young voters for a variety of reasons. Is it a good idea to be the president who shut down TikTok?
Well, is TikTok going to be shut down, though? I mean, help me understand here. What they're saying is that TikTok has to have stateside ownership, right? That's what they're asking
for. That's what they're asking for, yeah.
So what's the problem there?
Well, we don't know how much influence the Chinese government has on ByteDance. That may be a key part of their business model.
Yeah.
And they might not be able to operate without the watchful eye of the Chinese Communist Party. We don't really know if that's actually the case. The CEO of TikTok is going in to meet with members of Congress this week, and he's obviously lobbying against this legislation.
Right.
I think maybe that gives some indication that if the legislation passed, there would be concerns about selling it to U.S. investors. It just might be that they're not interested in it, or they're trying to hold fast to their principles and not give in to the congressional mob. But at least the way I interpret it is there's a chance that TikTok could be banned. And even if it weren't, this bill could be seen politically as an effort to shut down TikTok because of malign foreign influence.
And yeah, and I guess you would, if the owners of TikTok are against this, which it makes sense that they would be, they certainly have a megaphone to get in front of their users to say that that's what's happening here, that they're trying to ban this thing that you love.
And that's exactly what they've tried to do. So that's what they're putting in that push alert to all of the app's users. It said Congress is trying to shut down TikTok. It didn't say Congress is trying to make us sell our app to U.S. investors, so we're not controlled by maligned foreign influences like the Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
So at least that's what they're claiming, and I think we have to take them at their word, at least for now. Now, maybe it's all a big bluff. Congress passes this bill. They sell it to, you know, whomever obnoxious rich person you can think of. Personal bias, I hope it's not Elon Musk.
I was going to say, don't summon his name.
Yes.
It's like,
he who shall, he's
like
he's
Voldemort.
Voldemort, yeah. I do not want his hands on another beloved application after he already ruined Twitter/X. So maybe it is that they're bluffing and they really do intend to sell it, but I just don't think we can be sure of that. They are at least representing this as it could lead to an actual ban on the app in the United States. But the other thing is, like, long term, it would probably be good for Joe Biden slash the Democratic Party slash people on the center left and center right to not have TikTok be as influential as it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a lot of what I would call smut that goes around on TikTok in terms of misinformation and out-of-context political attacks and just, like, political commentary that becomes a fad among young people. Like, there was this phenomenon maybe a month or two ago of people praising Osama bin Laden's letter where he justified 9/11 in the United States. And there was this, like, TikTok meme of young people saying how, oh, this, you know, this was super compelling. So it is smut. And maybe in the long term, it would be useful as a policy of this country to get rid of the application, although the market for it is still there. So I'm sure Facebook would pick up the pieces. Last angle, though.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
Is the Donald Trump angle.
Oh.
So he tried to ban TikTok when he was president. It got tied up in the court system. Now he's flip-flopped. He is claiming that he is against this legislation banning TikTok because that would give more power to Mark Zuckerberg, who he dislikes. The claim that he's alleged against Mark Zuckerberg, which is frankly BS, is that Zuckerberg rigged the 2020 election on Facebook to get people to vote for Joe Biden.
Oh, that old thing?
That old thing.
Right, okay.
When really it was Zuckerberg had a voter registration program running on Facebook during the election. That's basically what it amounts to.
Okay.
I'm not going to get into the details of that.
Yeah.
The other Trump angle here is there is a longtime Republican donor who was Trump skeptical. He happens to be a major investor in TikTok.
Oh.
And he recently had a meeting with Donald Trump. So I think there's some understanding out there that this might be realpolitik, as they say, where he's trying not to piss off a new investor into his campaign, which might struggle for money, especially as he has to pay some of his legal bills. So that's a possible angle as well. Now, we know Donald Trump has a lot of influence among Republican members of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So either before this makes it to the House floor or in the United States Senate, the fact that Donald Trump is in opposition, maybe that conjures up 41 votes to defeat this.
I'm trying to unpack China's interests here. If you're China and you own TikTok, you run TikTok, right? It strikes me that their interest in TikTok is not one of making a profit on TikTok.
No, it is not.
Their primary interest is influence.
Yes.
Right. So,
and information.
So to me, it would make sense that if China were forced to sell TikTok to an independent U.S. interest, that China could just as well say, yes, fine, shut it down. Because we don't care about it anymore. It's of no use to us. If we cannot control it, it's of no use to us. And it's probably politically better for us, for the U.S. administration, to take the hit of shutting it down. So we'll choose option B. Shut it down.
Well, why haven't they done that so far? I mean, this has already caused a big PR backlash. There have been efforts to shut down TikTok at the executive level, among members of Congress. Why hasn't China already said, you know what, F it? Like,
well, I would guess that every day that they have control over it is a day where they have opportunity to influence. So keep it running.
And so that might be of some undeterminative use to them. I don't want to imply anything, but like they might be getting more out of this interaction than we even know about.
Would that come to an end if they were forced to sell? If it were still running, but theoretically there would be some oversight to make sure that it was independent of Chinese influence.
I mean, that's why I think they're so resistant to this legislation passing.
Okay.
Because they might lose whatever influence they do have. And I don't know how much of that is being foisted on the CEO of TikTok as he lobbies members of Congress. I don't know what the true motivation is. But obviously, everybody's fighting this. I mean, I don't think there would be such an outcry against this legislation. I don't think there would have been push alerts to TikTok users if somebody out there wasn't very concerned about this legislation passing, forcing TikTok to sell the company to a United States person.
Right. I guess what I'm saying is that the forcing them to sell could be the option they don't choose. They could just say, we're going to burn it down.
Let's burn this whole thing to the ground.
Yeah
it's possible. But then they'd also, it's a catch-22 because they'd lose out on whatever they're gaining from TikTok's current ownership and its user base, which is a lot of people, especially in Generation Z. Their minds are being shaped, they're being influenced by the voices they see on TikTok. So I think China fears losing that. Now,
Right. Maybe
they would just shut it down because it would be the better of two bad options from their perspective if this bill were to pass.
Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah, so maybe they will. I guess what I'm saying is there's a reason they're trying so hard, or somebody is pulling the strings in order to stop this bill from passing in the first place.
Yeah.
To maintain the status quo.
Okay. Yeah, Yes, I understand what you're saying. I think your argument is a good one. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, I mean, unlike a lot of the things we talk about, I think we're going to get a resolution relatively soon. By the time we next record, we'll at least have an idea of the dispensation of this legislation in the House, and then it'll get to the Senate. All we know so far is that Rand Paul seems very skeptical. And when he's skeptical of something, he can make life a living hell for other senators for a period of weeks if
he
wants to
best.
Delay this. Yeah, and he's proud of it.
Right,
he would put that on his epitaph.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting story here because I think, the back and forth you and I are having about it, I think points out how non-obvious, some of the potential pathways are for this.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll have a link to that in the show notes. My story this week is a little bit in the weeds here, but I think worth talking about. This is from the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They sent an amicus brief to the Ninth Circuit Court in response to a ruling that the court handed down, which the EFF believes expands copyright. And what's going on here is Oracle, who I think we all know is a big software company, they came after another company called Rimini, whose software was had an interoperability with Oracle software. And Oracle said that this interoperability violated copyright, that Rimini's software's ability to function alongside of and intertwined with Oracle was too much, that without Oracle's permission or blessing, that this was a copyright violation. The Ninth Circuit agreed with that. And
a district court agreed with that, right? Not the Ninth Circuit.
I'm sorry. Yes, yeah. You are correct. Keep me straight. A district court
legal
agreed
nerd
with
chimes
that.
In with the procedural.
No. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it. And so I guess what that means is that this is going to the Ninth Circuit. Because Rimini has appealed. Yes, that would be
that
the process here?
Yep.
All right, thank you. So the EFF has chimed in here, and they're saying that the district court ruling was bad policy and bad law. They're saying that interoperability doesn't fall under this copyright problem, and that the way the law defines this is that software needs to be of substantial similarity in order to be a violation of copyright. And what they're saying is basically, Rimini didn't make something that is similar to Oracle's software. They made something that merely interops with it.
Interoperable.
With it. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Is interoperable with.
Right. And what they're saying is that this is a dangerous, an unacceptable expansion of copyright, and that it gives the bigger company, in this case Oracle, too much control over how the users use their product and too much control over what independent third-party software developers would be able to do. So imagine, for example, if you're Adobe and you have Photoshop, and Photoshop has a plugin functionality, right? What they're saying is that if Adobe were able to pick and choose who could make plugins and what those plugins would do, that's not good for the users, because they'll have less choice over the
stifles types of innovation.
Right. The things that interrupt, that basically what they're saying is here, the top-level software provider should not have ultimate say over how things interact with their software. Do I have that right? Is my description of what's going on here adequate, Ben, from your point of view?
I think it's exactly right. And okay. I mean, this is a very widespread phenomenon. I mean, think of any tech platform, whether it's software or a social media site.
Yeah.
Everybody wants a piece of the action. So they create a plugin that is interoperable with that software or that site.
Right.
If that were deemed, as this district court has said, to be a copyright infringement, a derivation, and only Facebook or Oracle got to choose which plugin could be interoperable with that site, that would really stifle a market of innovation in terms of making these sites better. Beyond that, it seems that at least what EFF is alleging, and this is compelling to me, is that this is a misapplication of a key precedent in the Ninth Circuit.
Mm.
So there's this case called MicroStar. The plaintiff in that case, FormGen, had published a video game following the adventures of an action hero named, this is incredible, Duke Nukem.
Oh, yeah, Duke Nukem, sure.
Yeah.
Everybody knows, well, my generation knows and loves Duke Nukem.
I guess I'm a little young for the Duke Nukem
era.
You
weren't around for the Duke Nukem era? Okay.
I'm just loving that that was this action hero's name.
Yeah.
So... And this is all written in the EFF summary here. The game included a software tool that allowed players themselves to build new levels of the game and share them with others. MicroStar downloaded hundreds of those user-created files and sold them as a collection. And the district court in that case said that this was a derivation. The key difference here is that the reason those user files were substantially similar is that they were basically sequels to the video game itself.
Mm.
If the user files had told a different story with different characters, they wouldn't be derivative works. This was basically adding a level to the video games that didn't already exist, but it wasn't substantially changing or adding a new functionality to the video game. So
right.
I think that's a really important distinction. And even EFF claims in that case that the district court might not have been correct, that they might have been too restrictive of MicroStar in that case.
So they were saying that the copyright was being applied in for the sake of the legal argument, the copyright was being applied to the characters and story elements, not the underlying engine of the video game.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I think that's the key distinction with the case at bar here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Is it has nothing to do with the creative works or the, you know, key defining features of Oracle's software. It's an add-on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way to interface directly with the product. So yeah, I mean, without getting into the nitty-gritty of copyright law, which I try to avoid in all of my everyday interactions,
yeah,
I do think this would have bad public policy consequences if the district court's decision were to stand, and I think that's why EFF is weighing in and just saying, you know, this would be bad for the industry. And this would really hurt innovation and small companies that are trying to make big software better.
Yeah. I've thought for quite a while now that copyright law here in the U.S. needs a fresh look. In my mind, it has not at all kept up with the changes in technology. And that was before we had all the stuff with OpenAI and generative things like that. And I wonder if this might be the thing that causes there to be a fresh look at copyright law.
This is one of your big hobby horses, this and the NTSB for cyber incidents.
Yeah.
I wholeheartedly agree with it. I don't know if this is going to be a high-profile enough case to be the catalyst, but it might start the movement.
Yeah, I don't think that this would be a catalyst for that. I think it's going to have to be something bigger. I think bigger things are going to have to be at stake here. And what I wonder is this notion that the courts have said already, like it's early days, right? But the courts have already said that AI-generated things cannot be copyrighted. I think that's a very interesting thing to say.
It sure is.
Right?
Like, yeah.
So if the AI thing can't be copyrighted, can my prompt be copyrighted? Can the things that are generated by or that are the work of humans be copyrighted? So there's all these things that haven't been determined yet. And as these things become more and more important for people who want to make money from them, I think we're going to see lobbying efforts and we might have to take a closer look at these things. Now, as you always point out, great. Come back to me in a decade.
Right.
You know, because that's how these things tend to churn through the system.
I'm excited to see what the Bittner Commission comes up with on revising copyright law.
Right. I'm going to become, what was his name? The guy who tilted at windmills, Don Quixote about copyright law. That'll be my thing, Bill. Oh, here he comes again.
I do think, like, I know everybody laughs at blue ribbon commissions, but this is really the perfect circumstance for it. With the fact that we're having these challenges of artificial intelligence, it's such a novel problem that maybe we do need to get a bunch of experts in a room to issue a high-profile public report mm-hmm. with recommendations. That's rarely a good solution, but this might be one instance where this would be a good solution.
Look, Ben, Mickey Mouse is in the public domain. I mean, crazy things can have happened, right?
I know.
Whoever thought?
We could just create our own Mickey Mouse show and nobody could sue us.
As long as he's Steamboat Willie Mickey Mouse, I noticed that, you know, the T-shirt company, Life is Good?
Yes.
Yes. So they have started making Steamboat Willie Mickey Mouse T-shirts.
They do it because they can.
I know.
It's
and good for
exciting.
Them. Good for them. Yes. Yes. All right. Well, we will have a link to the EFF's brief here for you to check out. Of course, we would love to hear from you. If there's something you'd like us to consider for the show, you can email us. It's caveat@n2k.com. And now, a message from CyberBit. Mastering cybersecurity is like mastering a sport. You build muscle memory through rigorous practice, then you train as a team to foster cohesion while operating under pressure. Like athletes, cybersecurity professionals thrive on hands-on simulation. But traditional courses, certifications, and open-source labs won't build you a winning team. You need CyberBit. CyberBit offers a hyper-realistic simulation environment for your SOC, IR, and C-suite to refine your skills, all using the market-leading SIEMs, EDRs, firewalls, and WAFs they use every day. CyberBit is offering CyberWire listeners a free live-fire exercise. Sign up your team now at cyberbit.com/cyberwire. Ben, I recently had the pleasure of speaking with Dakota Carey from Sentinel Labs, and we're talking about an interesting thing here. This is China's cyber-focused media campaign. You know, China's trying to have some influence here on the way that people consider the information they put out in the cybersecurity domain. Here's my conversation with Dakota Carey.
You know, at multiple times in the last couple of years have I read reporting on information and reports that had come out of China's cybersecurity industry about U.S. hacking operations. And each time I had read through these reports and then talked with other security professionals about them, they've been generally derided for their lack of technical content. And so it was in talking with peers and particularly a friend from a conference in 2022 at LabsCon, whose main argument was effectively that China had been complaining that its own university had been hacked. And this person's presentation was actually on China hacking into universities in the United States. And so their point was, you're hypocritical. And in addition to being hypocritical, you're not even actually providing the data behind your claims. And so kind of running with, their analysis and the way that they were having to deal with Chinese attacks on U.S. institutions, I decided to say, okay, what is behind China's push into this space? Is it novel? When did it begin? Why are they doing this? And so the content of this report reflects my attempt to describe and demonstrate why China decided to proceed with this media campaign, what caused its behavior to change, and the way in which that campaign has or has not been successful.
Well, let's dig into some of the details here together. I mean, first of all, how would you describe the campaign itself?
China's campaign to promote the narrative that the U.S. is the empire of hacking revolves around past leaks of U.S. intelligence documents. Its claims are frequently, if not always, unsubstantiated by actual technical details that analysts have come to expect from Western cybersecurity firms. And we have to take on face value the claims that Chinese cybersecurity companies and the government are making. And I say and the government because since the 2021 joint statement from the US, the EU, and the UK about China's actions in cyberspace, the Chinese government, through its media institutions like Global Times, has consistently put out English language press coverage of these reports from Chinese cybersecurity companies. And the push is very clear that they are trying to move this information into English language documentation, make it widely accessible, and then promote that narrative to a global audience, even if the underlying technical details can't be verified.
And to what degree do they have success here? I mean, do these reports get picked up and covered?
There are a number of instances where cybersecurity companies reporting and thus, what the government says about U.S. hacking operations gets picked up by foreign press. And I'm sympathetic to why these stories get picked up. This is, the United States' largest near-peer competitor in international relations, making allegations about U.S. activity. And in a lot of ways, it is newsworthy in and of itself that the Chinese government is lodging these allegations. Unfortunately, they are not substantiating those claims in the way that we have come to expect, particularly around cybersecurity.
To what degree are they substantiating the claims, if at all?
That's a good question. The allegations of hacking against Northwestern Polytechnical University in China that came out in the middle of 2022 are accompanied by what is ostensibly a technical validation of these claims. And the documents provided by the China Virus Emergency Response Center, which is a government agency of the PRC, includes dates that are partially blurred out. So you never know what year these events are occurring in. It may say, November 1, 2000, and then the last two digits are cut off. Or the IP address is only half included. So you'll get the first two decimals, and then the last half of the IP address is cut off. And so the things that researchers could use to verify the claims by looking at their own tooling are not provided. And particularly in the case of the allegations of hacking this particular university, it was a lot of those dates were probably cut off to hide the fact that this campaign was likely more than a decade old at the time that China decided to publish this report.
Is their audience their allies? In other words, is that who they're looking for amplification here from, the folks that they can count on for support to amplify this message?
It's a good question. Propaganda has as many audiences as are receptive to it and as many audiences as the government is trying to convince. So we look to countries that have close or are in proximity to the PRC and their relationship with China. And using these publications kind of as a tool to bludgeon the United States in our relationship with those countries is a useful outcome. In the same way that the U.S. government will absolutely be highlighting the leaks from the Ministry of Public Security contractor, ISUN, that happened earlier in 2024, in the way that we will be using that to underline how the Chinese government is hacking into those governments and using that data for foreign espionage or transnational repression of political dissidents. These reports kind of fit into a kind of a larger campaign that's going on between these two countries in order to persuade people about the merits of the other person's arguments.
So one of the things that your research points out here is kind of the escalation and shift in strategy from the Chinese here. That there are some things that kind of shifted in 2021. Can you highlight what exactly happened then?
Yeah, absolutely. So before 2021, Chinese cybersecurity companies and the government only ever recycled leaked U.S. intelligence documents or threat intelligence from other cybersecurity companies. And so in the report, you can see there's a timeline very clearly of Kaspersky or another company publishing about alleged U.S. operations. And until 2021, there are no publications from PRC cybersecurity companies that independently attribute hacking operations to the United States. They only ever provide additional analysis of tools or backdoors that have been leaked. And then in 2021, the U.S. government, the EU, and the U.K. Put out a joint statement saying that China has been behaving irresponsibly in cyberspace. The proximal cause for this is the abuse of four vulnerabilities in Microsoft Exchange servers in 2021. And as these Chinese hacking teams, it had previously been used by only a small number of teams. As these hacking teams find out that this vulnerability is going to be patched, they basically automate their exploitation of it and pass it off to a number of other teams. And so there is a dramatic spike in the abuse of these vulnerabilities against Microsoft Exchange servers before a patch becomes available for it. And it's this like automation and scaling that ultimately leaves these servers vulnerable to exploitation by both other Chinese groups and anyone else who is capable of finding the web shells that have been left behind. That causes these governments to kind of band together and call China out for its actions. And that joint statement really upsets the PRC. The Chinese government prefers to engage diplomatically with countries in a one-on-one basis. And that's because China sees itself as a self-described large country. And when it engages with smaller countries, it obviously has a significant bargaining and negotiation advantage over those countries in a one-on-one case. And so it is the combination of all of these countries coming together to call out China's behavior that causes Beijing to sit upright. And they suddenly realize the impact that Western coverage of Chinese hacking operations has had on their global image. And after that 2021 statement is when the Chinese government starts to take action, trying to shape the global narrative around U.S. hacking operations and to push the blame into the U.S. court. And it rolls out this claim that the U.S. is the empire of hacking.
It's really fascinating to me. I mean, in my own experience, you know, the coverage that we've done at the CyberWire, it seems as though, and I'm going to exaggerate here for effect, but, you know, the U.S. will say something, will highlight a piece of hacking or espionage that they feel is the responsibility of China, and the response from the Chinese embassy will be to kind of point and say, neener, neener, no, it was you. Or, you know, is that sort of thing. I mean, and it's predictable as to almost be amusing. I guess what I wonder about is the bar this low? Is this a reflection of where we are in terms of international discourse, where you can make these claims without substantial evidence and still have them, to a certain degree, be effective?
I think from China's perspective, the answer up until today has been yes.
Hmm.
And I think that the U.S. and cybersecurity companies in Europe, in the United States, Israel, and elsewhere have done a very good job at substantiating their claims of an attack, attribution of those attacks to particular groups and thus to particular governments. And it's actually become, you know, so professionalized that this information about which groups are hacking which targets has become interoperable across cybersecurity companies. You know, we can say a threat actor's name, and people at different companies can understand which cluster of activity we're talking about. And that's because there are technical indicators that all of those people have access to, and they understand what they're referring to. And unfortunately, the way that China is publishing these allegations and reports, that is not possible. We can't verify the claims that these companies in the PRC and that the government of the PRC are producing. And that's it's unfortunate, and it should be discounted when the Chinese government does make these claims. And you know, part of the value of the timeline that I've put together in the report is showing that after the 2021 statement and China decides to go on the offensive, it doesn't have success immediately out the gate. In fact, the first handful of reports are not picked up by Western press at all. It is just publications that are getting kind of kicked around in the Chinese media space. And they respond to this lack of uptake. They try to tout reports at press conferences. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson brings up a report that is 2 years old to try and talk about it. And so they're pushing really hard, and they find that actually what's missing is a victim. And that it is when an organization is identified as a victim that the allegations gain traction. And so that's how, in the middle of 2022, we get these allegations of hacking Northwestern Polytechnical University by the NSA, is because China adds this in, and that's when coverage begins to pick up. And since then, China has released a number of reports with victims or alleged victims that are identified, and still does not include the technical reporting. But what they've done is they've identified the thing that's necessary to tell a good story, as it were. And so they are altering and adjusting the reports to what will gain traction, and they are not at all adjusting the publication of the underlying technical details that would validate their claims.
And to be clear here, I mean, China has the technical capabilities that if they chose to do so, they could include technical details.
I believe that they could include technical details for a number of threat actors, if they so chose. I don't know the exact visibility that China has into any one particular actor's operations, but we do know that they make these publications and technical details for non-US threat actors. They are very happy to publish technical details and analysis of Blue Lotus operations, which are thought to be associated with the Vietnamese government. So they're very happy to talk about and do talk about and track other countries' behaviors in cyberspace. But when it comes to the U.S., they are not willing to publish that technical analysis.
What do you suppose this looks like in the long term? I mean, is this a strategy that China can stick with, or will this ultimately work against their interests?
Well, I hope, and the intention behind this report was to draw attention to this issue by other analysts and people in the press to say that when the next time China makes a claim like this, as we know that they will, that it is met with an appropriate amount of scrutiny, and that those claims are not echoed or published until there are supporting technical details provided that can validate what is being claimed. It is about raising the bar for reposting or republishing or considering the allegations that China is making. And I just think that that is an absolutely appropriate and necessary editorial standard in considering what it is the Chinese government says. Because the Chinese government says a lot that is not true. And, you know, they continue to deny genocide against Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And that has been validated time and again by countless sourcing, UN Human Rights Council, etc. And so we let them get away with a lot more than we should. And the point of this report is to say that they should stand on equal footing if they're going to make claims.
Ben, what do you think?
This is really fascinating. It's a lot I didn't really know about, and the contrasts with how the U.S. and the U.K. and the EU talk about cyber incidents and the way it's reported on in the Chinese government.
Yeah.
The difference in terms of providing the tactical details. I mean, it's just something I hadn't really learned much about. So I thought it was just a really interesting conversation.
It's interesting to me, too, and kind of, I guess, a statement on where we are in the world today, that the bar is so low when it comes to presenting your evidence.
Right.
Right. You can just say...
Say whatever you want. Nobody's going to stop you.
Yeah. Right, right. And that being able to present your case without any evidence does not automatically result in you being mocked and dismissed.
Laughed out of the proceeding. Yep.
Right. That's where we are. All right. Well, our thanks to Dakota Carey from Sentinel Labs for joining us. We do appreciate them taking the time. That is our show. We want to thank all of you for listening. N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. Our executive producer is Jennifer Iben. The show is edited by Trey Hester. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpie. I'm Dave Bittner.
And I'm Ben Yellen.
Thanks for listening.